Hello, listeners, and welcome to another episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. My name is Dr. Jamie Madigan, and my mission is to look into the psychology literature and come back with things to help you understand why games are so often made the way that they are, why they are marketed and sold the way they are, and why we gamers behave as we do when we play. So I think we can all kind of get into a rut sometimes. Keep playing the same games, keep making the same arguments, keep talking about the same people. I know for sure that I have my favorite genres and gaming experiences and the same standbys that I go back to time and time again. So to help branch this podcast out a little bit, I'm doing a short series of episodes that branch out a bit on the whole psychology of games topic. I've got plans in upcoming episodes to talk with guest experts about the psychology of Dungeons & Dragons, for example, and about how things that look an awful lot like video games are being used to assess employees in the workplace. But let's start off easy with something that's not too far afield. Let's talk this episode about why people are attracted to certain mobile games, and whether there's more than just surface explanations. I always have a few games installed on my phone, just in case I need to kill some time or want to play something while I'm out somewhere. Holiday parties might be the perfect use case here, in fact. Let's see, I'm looking at my phone now, and I've got Threes, Lara Croft Go, Desert Golfing, Candy Crush Saga, Hoplite, and something called Solitarica, which is like some sort of role-playing solitaire game. These are all pretty good games, but kind of old. Maybe it's time that I downloaded something new. But of course, that would require figuring out what to download, and that's no small task. There are, I think, more mobile games out there to download than there are stars in the sky. That's how it feels, anyway. And psychology is pretty consistently tells us that when we have such surfeit of choices that we look for strategies and heuristics for making those decisions easier. We may play something from the same series or developer. If I like Candy Crush Saga, maybe I'll check out Candy Crush Soda Saga or something else from King. Or if I like games with high fantasy aesthetics, I'll look for app icons featuring wizards and stuff. And I'd probably be just as likely to look for strategies that remove options from lists of choices. If I'd had bad experience with games featuring resource management, for example, I might just leave those right off. And what's more, much of this might happen with little to no conscious thought. Our brains have evolved to become really good at applying these kinds of decision-making rules, and we tend to apply them automatically or let them be guided by gut instinct or emotion. In short, we develop an affinity for certain types of mobile games, and then we let that affinity drive our decisions about what to play next. But how does this process work? And what are the different aspects of games that we develop affinities for? Can game designers measure these kinds of stated or internal preferences and use that information to market games to us or even decide what kinds of games to make? What are the potential costs and benefits of this kind of approach to the industry and to players? These are the kinds of questions that I will discuss with my guest expert in this episode of the podcast. Before I do, though, please remember that I've laid out for you an intricate array of articles about psychology and video games over at psychologyofgames.com. After you check that out, you can see how to follow me on social media, how to subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. You can even follow links to support me on patreon.com/POG for a buck or two a month. And you'll get a super secret podcast feed where you can get an ad-free version of this podcast and audio versions of any new articles that I publish on the site. And now, let's get on with the interview. All right. Thanks again for joining us on the interview portion of the podcast. My guest this episode is Ishai Smaja, and I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly. He is a product manager with the Experimentation Group at King, who is the makers of mobile games and other products that you've probably not only heard of, but played. Ishai, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Super excited to begin your show.
Awesome. So you want to kind of expand on that introduction a little bit? Tell us what you do at King and what your background is and what you've been working on?
Sure. So my background is generally with management consulting. And 3 years ago, I decided to make the switch to product and gaming in particular, and King even more in particular, and never looked back. Over the last 3 years at King, I've been working on products or rather games for the entire lifecycle of games, so through prototyping, to play testing, and live games. At the moment, I'm working with the Experimentation Group, which is the part of the organization that's in charge of pushing the envelope, trying to do things differently and trying to learn as much as we can about our players, about the industry, to make the best games we can.
And that probably involves a lot of digging through mountains of data, I imagine.
Sometimes yeah. It involves quite a lot of data.
As well as like experimental work, do you kind of experiment with players and run focus groups or testing of any kind?
Definitely, we run loads of tests. So we have tests that are going on the live games to improve everything from the UX of the game, gameplay. Whenever you open a King Games, you're likely to see lots of features going on. And over the last few years, those kind of experiments have really stepped up our game and made our games much more fun with new features that draw on competition. Mm-hmm. Between players that work to give rewards and make the game just more fun and more bespoke to what our players want. So there's this aspect of actually running A-B tests in live games, which for someone who loves data, it's this huge sandbox, and it's amazing to have so many users and players playing our games. On the other hand, there's a lot of qualitative work that is being done trying to learn from best practices, not only in games, but across the industry, and using external data sources from different business intelligence websites we have access to, like App Annie, that some of my research is based on.
Now, what is that? Is that that's like a repository of information about all kinds of different yes. mobile games, right?
Yes, and so not just mobile games, but all the apps. So it's a repository about usage and monetization data from across the industry.
Okay, and so the reason that I wanted to have you on the show is, you'd reached out to me and pointed me to some of the research that you've done there at King, looking at a number of different things that are of interest to anybody probably who's listening to this podcast. So it was one of them was around how you look at player motivations, sort of like what motivates people to play games in general and what motivates them to grab or why do they gravitate towards specific types of games they do, or why do they call certain games like their favorites versus others? And, I've had people on the show talking about self-determination theory of motivation in games, and had like Nikki talking about Quantic Foundry and their approach they take to it. So what have you done in that area, and sort of what have you discovered about, why people like the games that they like?
So I think the story of all the research I've done started with the game I was working on when I first joined King. And when the game was canceled, some of our team members went off to work on different projects. And we really tried to understand our players and to give them what they want. But it's quite hard because you can't just go around and ask millions of people what they want. And even if you could, you wouldn't be able to make much with the answers you'd get. They would be too varied.
Right.
The first thing we tried doing was looking at the big market data and trying to look at the affinity, which is the connection between games. So think about it as what information you can get about a person from knowing they play a specific game. And it works with everything, really. So if I tell you somebody drinks water, you can't really deduce a lot about that person. But if I tell you they drink premium whiskey, you get a better image in your mind of who that person might be. So we've mapped out all these connections, and we got this really interesting map of the market that I'd be keen to elaborate on further. But that gave us half the answer, right? Like, that gave us the answer of what the connections are. And what we really wanted to understand was not only what the connections are, but why they are what they are. So we tried looking at the...
Sorry, when you say what the connections are, can you say a little bit more about that? Like, connections between what?
Right. So imagine the game's audiences as different nodes. So each node would be the audience for a given game. The bigger the audience is, the bigger the node is.
Okay. And
those are connected to different games. So if I'm telling somebody plays Candy Crush, they're quite likely to be playing Candy Crush Soda. But this word quite likely doesn't mean much. So we can put a number on it, and that number is the affinity value. So let's say these two games would have an affinity value of 10. It means that players of Candy Crush are 10 times more likely to play Candy Crush Soda than players of other games, and vice versa. So it's a symmetric value. But the thing is, we didn't just do it for one game. It's instead of looking at one game at a time. We've mapped the connections for all the top games in the market. So the biggest games that we've had data on and all the games that are within 1 degree of separation. Then okay.
And this was not just King games. This was all of the apps that you were able to get data on.
So these were all the mobile games in the market. Really. So everything from casual puzzles like the ones King makes to resource management game to shooters and really hardcore RPGs. We've looked at all of them and mapped the connections because having data just on one type of game isn't as valuable as having it in the context of all the other games that are out there.
Right.
Right. And we found out some really cool stuff. We saw a lot of connections between genres that explained a lot of the phenomenons we were seeing in the market. We saw different genres grow. We saw at the expense of which other genres that growth was happening. We saw how some games that entered the market were really game changers, how they created their own genres, or how they made the genre explode. And we could also see the connections moving around over time, which is kind of hard to explain with just audio because it's a very, you know, a map is a very visual thing.
Yeah. And I will definitely share images of the map and the other things that I'm sure you're going to be talking about so people can get a sense of what it looks like and how it might operate. I'll put that up on the website at psychologygames.com with the show notes that go with this episode. But, you know, I'm looking at what you're talking about. And like you said, there's like a bunch of different colored dots, which are the nodes, and those are connected to one or more nodes by lines that show the strength of the relationship. And it's kind of this massive, it almost looks like a giant, like cotton candy or candy floss, like lump with like sprinkles all over it. But it looks like you had a ton of data there to work with.
We had loads of data, and we've used some software called Gephi that's usually used to map social networks, whether they be things like Facebook or looking at biology, so mapping a lot of biological processes or physical processes. And what we've done is we used this affinity data to simulate gravity. So we got different games to cluster together. And I think the interesting bit here is that they weren't clustered together based on genre taxonomy. So it's not that we put all the resource management games at one place and all the shooters at another place. They were clustered together by the actual audience preferences. So
there were things about the games besides the genre that made people gravitate towards the same set of games.
Exactly. That made us think that genres or the definition of genres might not be as important as we initially thought. And looking at that, we try to understand what we can learn from the likes of Netflix or Amazon that are, you know, they're leaders in generating data, in generating TV shows, in generating content, and they have a much higher hit rate than other networks. So they have a much higher likelihood of success.
Yeah, so you had like a really interesting point about Netflix is that especially when they started producing their own content, they didn't look so much to genres as they looked at like, well, what do people who like this show tend to like? Like what characteristics outside of genre? And then they did sort of really specific programming that would appeal to those groups of people. Is that the kind of thing that you're talking about?
Yep, exactly. Because saying, you know, if I'm saying I'm a 30-something-year-old guy, what kind of show would I like? It's very hard to say. Or if I'm saying, it gets easier when you're talking about a genre. So if I'm like crime shows, I'm more likely to like other crime shows. But also these type of genres differ a lot between them. So you get very light crime TV shows. You get some that are borderline horror TV shows and so on. And people watch different TV shows at different times of day for different reasons. Over time, they change, and the same goes towards games. So people would play different games for different reasons, different games for the same reasons, or the same game for different reasons. And what we set out to do is to understand those reasons of why people would play those specific games. And with some genres, it's easy. If you like puzzle games, you're more likely to like other puzzle games. But some genres have a very wide definition, if that makes sense. So if you're looking at resource management, you can manage a flower shop, or you can manage an alien army. And those two things would appeal to very different players, even though taxonomy-wise, they would both be resource management games.
Right. So the gameplay mechanics might be very similar, but the other things about them would make them look like completely different games.
Exactly. And part of what we had with this map is when you have actual data, you have a lot of biases introduced. So first of all, you have different groups of players that might be very different, and we only see the average. The second thing is that marketing also makes a big impact. So part of what I saw is that when a game is launched, they would have connections to many, many, many more games just because companies tend to advertise in as many outlets as they can.
And their own games, right?
Exactly. So both within their own games and have just paid marketing on the different ads you'd get in mobile games. Mm-hmm. We kind of looked for a way to try and understand the underlying reasons behind those connections, and that's where we started looking at self-determination theory and at the Quantic Foundry framework.
And did that lead you to any insights or answers?
Yeah. So first of all, I think there's both of them are very good frameworks, but they are good for very different things. So with self-determination theory, you get the autonomy, relatedness, and competence. And those three factors are very good at estimating a game once players have played it, right? So if you've played a game, I can ask you, have you felt autonomous playing it? Have you felt like you're connected to the characters in the game or to other players in the game? But it's very hard to apply those things about general preferences. So if I ask somebody, do you like a game where you're autonomous? Most people would say yes. And if I ask them to quantify it, it's very hard. So on a scale of 1 to 5, how autonomous do you like to be in the games you play? Those measures are very good for games that are already out there and players have already played, and they're very good at estimating how well will games perform once they're launched. But if you're trying to understand the underlying reasons as to why people play games, that's where we found the Quantic Foundry framework, or rather a variation of it, to be super useful. So,
Yeah, so it seems like the question isn't, like, somebody can play a game and you can ask them, did you feel autonomous? Did you feel a sense of mastery? And that can give you a pretty good idea, but it almost seems like, hey, here's a game. Do you expect, if you play this game, you know, to feel autonomous? Then that's a different question, or it's a more difficult one to answer.
Also because you wouldn't know until you've actually played it.
Yeah. Exactly right, yeah.
To be tasty, well, you can assume based on looking at it, but you wouldn't be able to say, like, how tasty it's going to be. Plus, if I ask people, would you like to have your food tasty? Everybody's going to say yes, but it would mean very different things for different people. And same goes for autonomy, relatedness, competence. Yeah. So relatedness for one person would be a very strong story. For somebody else, it would be having players to interact with. And even when you talk about what story they would like, it varies a lot.
And so the Quantic Foundry model has many more factors, characteristics of games, excitement, destruction, fantasy, story. Like, so it's a much more sort of faceted and detailed model to understanding why people like certain games than something like self-determination theory. So why did you find the Quantic Foundry model more useful?
Because with the Quantic Foundry model, we were able to create sort of a profile for different games and a profile for different players. So I was able to match the two. I was able to say players or the audience of this game are interested primarily in competition, then they're very interested in completion, and they would like a little bit of design. Whereas this game that they are playing answers the need for competition and completion, but nothing where it comes to design, which is a way to identify opportunities. So if you're seeing for a different genre that's quite popular, that there is a key motivational need missing, then you can deduce that if you would be able to fulfill that need, you'd be able to appeal to that audience. Furthermore, if you have a bunch of games and a bunch of genres, you could try and see which games fulfill that need well, and then you could draw inspiration. You could try and understand what they're doing well and sort of apply that, which is a lot of what goes on with what's called hybrid games, where you take elements from one game and you mix them with another. And for that, the questions that, or the motivations that Quantic Foundry uses were very suitable. We had to make some adjustments to make them more compatible with the type of games you have on mobile.
How so?
Well, I think some question that when I took the Quantic Foundry survey myself, they've used is I like to be of destruction, which would work with some mobile games, but doesn't really resonate with a lot of the elements you have in some more casual mobile games. Mm-hmm. And along with the team here at King and the help of many producers, artists, designers, and really people from all disciplines, we've tried to construct our own survey that was inspired by the Quantic Foundry one, but would encompass more things you'd get in mobile games that maybe you don't get as much in AAA titles. So a lot of the need to build something, to create, to nurture, which is the opposite of...
destruction.
Yeah. But isn't as prevalent in the questions that were used. And we've also made some changes in the actual methodology of how do we measure those things against one another, stepping away from percentile system to a ranked list. Mm. But that might be getting a bit too technical.
But it made the data more suitable to your purposes, it sounds like.
Exactly, which also allowed us to measure Euclidean distances between the different games and the different genres. Mm-hmm. So we had another measure to compare to the affinity data, which was connection. So Euclidean distance basically means we take all the points, so with the distance between all the different motivational components, and we translate it to one number, which is the sort of the distance between those two games. Mm-hmm. And then we could have compared that to the affinity data and try to understand how good of a predictor is the motivational profile to the actual affinity and connection between games. And we saw it was a pretty good predictor. So we got a correlation factor of around 0.6.
So if I understand right, it sounds like you have a measure. These measures, like, would people fill them out, or were they meant to describe games?
Yeah, so we've done two things. So when people answer the survey, they would answer about their preferences of what they would like out of games in general, mobile games in general. So they'd have a list of statements, and they were asked to rank them from to take the top three out of a list of whichever how many we've had there, and to repeat it a few times. And then further down the road, they were asked about specific games which they've named as their favorite games. So we wanted games that they've actually played for a while. And then we were able to compare them. So what they want out of the games and what they're getting out of the games that they're playing. And those gaps are where you could create value for the players, really, by giving them things that they're lacking in the games. And we can theoretically create.
Right. So you could create like archetypes or, you know, models of players, like, okay, these are players who really enjoy like this particular kind of game that gives them a lot of challenge and some competition elements, but they don't care about fantasy or story at all.
Exactly.
So you might look then, for example, like I imagine one use that this might have is to target marketing. Or information. So people who are really into a game that fits that bill could be told about another like similar game, even if it's a completely different like theme, for example. Might look different at first glance, but hey, this is really hitting on all the buttons that you said that you like or that people like you tend to like.
That's very true, right? So the first thing is for marketing, because if we are able to have a player archetype, then it's easier to target them. But it's also, and I can't remember who said it originally, but it's better to make some people very happy than a lot of people semi-happy.
Okay.
And in the context of games, that means if I know, let's say, that on average, people who play Candy Crush want to have a little bit more design, that's fine, that's interesting. But if I could say that there is a subsegment of roughly 30% that want a lot more design, that's more valuable, right? So it seems to me to know if there are players that really, really, really want something, or it's just something that on average they would be a nice to have. which impacts the developer position. And creating the player archetypes enabled us to do that, because we could see, based on those archetypes, not only what would they like in different games, but what is their propensity, based on other questions we've had in the questionnaire, what is their propensity to try out new games? So how likely they are to actually try out something new if we give it to them? And the flip side of the coin is, how loyal are they going to be? Because if they're very likely to try out new things, then, you know, they're going to try things from competitors as well. Or what is their propensity to spend? What kind of themes do they like on this specific archetype and so on, which made it easier for game makers and game designers to have an image in their head of who they're designing their game for. Because designing a game for a 45-year-old woman or a 20-year-old guy doesn't really get you any further to figuring out what they want. But when you're talking about what their needs, what they like in games, then you can make games that are massively appealing to a lot of people, or that are massively appealing to a small niche group you're interested in.
Yeah, it makes me think about a few episodes I had Jason Vandenberg on, who's a AAA game developer, most recently For Honor, that he put out, and he's now at ArenaNet. And he, like, the whole topic of that podcast episode was, like, you don't necessarily know what people want, like, as a game designer. And your insights and your decisions need to be driven by data and an understanding of the psychology of personality and preferences and the psychology of motivation around what people are going to want to buy and what they're going to play and what they're going to put down and so forth. So that definitely resonates to me from that point of view as well. And so it seems like this sort of data could, like you said, give you a window or some information about, well, what kinds of games should we develop next? How can we make a different game that still capitalizes on what we know works for these specific types of people? Am I on the right track there, or is that?
Yeah, definitely. I think, like, as you said, it's really hard to get into the head of your players and figure out what they would like and what would make them happier playing their games and how you can innovate with things they actually like. And, you know, a lot of people that are game designers or work in the gaming industry in general like playing games, and they usually like playing not only the type of games that their players like, but most game designers I know like epic RPGs, and a lot of them that I've spoken with, they got into this industry to begin with because they wanted to design this super complex system or super complex RPG, and those things that we might like in the gaming industry aren't necessarily what some of the players would like, especially when you're looking at more casual puzzles. And that kind of helps us understand the levels of complexity looking for in the type of narrative in their game, the amount of competition, the amount of complexity or collection. Part of what we saw doing this motivational profiling is that it's usually better not to be the jack of all trades, but to be master of a few of them.
Right. So it seems like you might come away from this with a series of almost recipes, to go back to the food analogy or the chef analogy, of how to prepare different types of games to appeal to different people and maximize the outcomes that you're interested in, like the amount of fun that they're having and their loyalty to your brand and all that good stuff. Does that...
So that's part of the result, right? We want to be able to make better games. We want to be able to market our games better. But I think at the end of the day, no amount of data would be able to create a game on its own, right? You can't just put data on one hand, end up with a recipe on the other hand. You have to have talented people, and you have to have, like, care and craft to go into the game making. So to go back to the food analogy, some of the most complex pastries, like French macaroons, are made from very, very simple and basic ingredients, but you need to know how to do it, right? You need to know, to have the training, you need to understand, and you need to have the touch and feel. So chefs would taste the food and feel like what needs to be changed. And same goes towards game making. You need game designers that know what they're doing, for lack of a better description. Same if you and I were given the script for an amazing TV show and we were to act it out ourselves, I doubt we would have managed to get it into a top grossing TV show.
Yeah. That is kind of where I was going with the question of, you know, do you worry that this is kind of a recipe, pardon the pun, for, you know, not innovating and not having new games or not having things that break out and define, you know, new genres, for example. If like we take this to its logical, scary extreme, and only work on what the data tells us is going to work and only make those products, then, you know, where's the next breakthrough come from?
So I think like that is a scary vision, but I don't think that's where we are heading. I think creativity and designers would always have their ideas and be able to create the things they're passionate about. But at the same time, I think it's good to be not data driven when you're creating new games, but rather data informed. I think it's always good to know better than to know less, to have more and more ways of looking at what your players like. And having this type of big data and these type of motivational models are great, but so is user testing and interviews and actually talking to the players and actually playing the games and trying to see, are they actually fun? Is this something that's enjoyable?
And then acting on those,
exactly,
those data and information that you get. So, you know, we've kind of talked about mostly in terms of mechanics for games, but there are, as we mentioned earlier, some other types of things that matter to whether or not somebody will have an affinity for a certain game. Can you speak a little bit more about that? Like, what are those building blocks of games? If mechanics are one of them, what are the others?
Yeah. So when we say mechanics, I think we should separate it into the core mechanics of what you do in the game. So let's say it's a puzzle game where you solve, it's a gravity puzzle where you need to get a ball into the goal. That would be the core of the game. That's what your second-to-second gameplay is. That's what you're doing when you're in the game. On top of that, you can have different meta layers, which is your meta progression. So you could have a map that you're progressing on. You could have a story that you're progressing through. You could be collecting artifacts. You could be collecting animals. You know, you could be building a base, whatever. And all of these are detached from the actual core. You could mix and match them. And those things are measured mostly by the different motivations. So you could have a game where you're collecting animals as the core of the game, or you could have a game where it's just like an endless runner where you're finding objects and the meta game is to collect the best gear to make you run faster. I don't know. But apart from that, there's two more building blocks. You get the core, you get the meta layer, and then you get the theme and the art style. So imagine I give you a pitch for this type of game. It's a game where you collect outfits and different parts to create your own unique look. Fine, that's the core of the game. Okay. Then I'll go on to talk about the meta and say, and as you do that, you cooperate with other players and you gain achievements in ranks and you progress to bigger, better, more interesting places to collect all those things. That's the meta layer. And now I can give you a theme, and the theme would be a twist. But you and all these other players are all zombies, and those parts you're collecting are different body parts and different weapons.
All right, you got me.
And that totally changes the type of game it is. But at the same time, I can now speak about the art style and say, but you're not scary zombies. You're just, you know, cute, adorable zombies. And that, again, would change the audience. So those are the four building blocks. And what we say is that depending on the and different types of games, the art style and the theme are also very important. So unfortunately, I'm still working on finding a way to evaluate the impact of those factors. But we can see, if you look at the maps I have in my article and you look at resource management, which is a very popular genre, and you try and see how important the theme is. So you see games that are ranging from games like Fallout Shelter, that tends to be more on the core side of things, to games that are much more casual and are farm-themed or hospital-themed, that would be connected to games with lighter audiences.
So do you have a sense that about how important each of those four things is? Are they equally important? Are there some that are more than others? Or does it depend on sort of in what combination they are?
I think it varies a lot. I think what we saw is that for some type of games, then the motivational factors are much more important. But as I said, they only explain on average about 0.6 of the correlation. So, you know, there's a lot that's yet to be explained, right? So even if I put down some of it to marketing, then there's still the matter of theme. And we saw that that matters, just not quantified yet. So with games that tend to be more generalized, like resource management, because you could build a space, you could build a fashion house, you could build a restaurant, you could build anything you want, really, and the mechanics would be similar. The theme and the art style tend to have a bigger impact. In terms of art style, when you get more specific, I think it becomes more important. So we mostly look at data, and what we saw is that people that like games that have an manga art style, so Japanese animation type, tend to like other games that have manga art style regardless of the core or the of the game.
Yeah, one of the articles that you sent over, you had a great example of something called Love Nikki Dress Up Queen, which is, quote, a lifestyle game focused on dressing up and collecting outfits. So it's the kind of thing that one of my daughters, you know, might play a lot, and she's gotten apps like that on her phone. And then you said that it had a surprisingly high affinity score with Fire Emblem Heroes, which is a much more traditional strategy RPG tactics type game that was made popular on like consoles and so forth, where it was much more in depth. But this version is, you know, simplified for that platform. And if you look at like the icons for the two apps, you know, on the App Store, like they look very similar. Like you might even switch them and nobody would be any the wiser, and you know, one could work for the other. And that's one of the reasons that those seemingly on the surface very different types of games might have a lot of shared audience.
Yep. So the Fire Emblem game is connected to more games with anime art style that are even casual. It's just that these two had such a similar art style that I just had to use it as an example.
Yeah, that's great.
My question is always what's next, right? When I'm finishing a research, I'm always trying to build on the learnings and try and see how we can apply it and how we can learn more. And I'm currently trying to learn more about the importance of theme and art style and how all those things work together. I'd be also super interested to know from people who work not on mobile, but on PC and console, how those things look.
Yeah. So do you have any feeling for that? Because that was something that crossed my mind as well. Like, how well would these methods and these techniques work for, you know, games on console or PC? Do you have any sense for that or any preliminary research?
I think affinity would definitely work. It's just a question of having a good enough data set. I'm sure, you know, like Steam or the PlayStation Store or the Xbox ones would have data about their users. And it's just a matter of mapping audience preferences. In terms of motivational playing, I don't see a reason why it shouldn't work on PC games or console games. It would be super interesting to see how all those things interact. Something else that I'm really interested in and looking at is the impact not just of what do you play, but also when do you play. Because when I'm playing games during my commute or when I'm playing them in the evening when everybody's gone to sleep, I'm playing different games for different reasons.
Yeah, that seems like a question that is much more relevant for the mobile market than it is where you have to sit down in front of a TV to play. Other than you have some products like the Nintendo Switch that are blurring those lines, and you know, you can do both.
Yep.
Do you think that this sort of thing would apply to like tabletop games, like role-playing games or board games? Because those sort of have their own separate genres and their own separate core mechanics apart from mobile games or other types of video games.
I don't see a reason why it wouldn't apply. I think a lot of mobile games or console and PC games are derived from different board games. A lot of the successful RPGs are derived from D&D. There's a lot of games that are variations of different board games or different card games. And and at the end of the day, what I really like about the Quantic Foundry model is that it feels very exhaustive. So apart from the nurturing factor that you can kind of combine into the design and a couple of other motivations, it really feels like it covers the reasons as to why people play not just mobile games or console games, but games in general. The simplicity of it is what makes it quite useful.
What kinds of collaboration or help or additional research would you want from, you know, academics and scientists and psychology, communications, economics, any of those types of fields? Like, what could they do that you think would synergize with this or would help push this type of research that you're doing forward or make it more useful?
So I'd be really interested in anyone that's developing more behavioral theories or motivational theories, even more so if those are things that look at the evolution of motivations over time and long-term evolutions during the point of life of players in the game. I think a lot of this kind of research is applicable not to just game design, which is what I find personally interesting, but also to the marketing of games. Because if you think about an App Store page, that's basically where you have your, where you show the players your unique value proposition. So you're saying, this is what my game is about, and you have the space of a few images and a few lines of text to get them interested in what you're offering and download the game. And I'm sure there's lots of research about marketing in general in the academia around psychology, communications, economics. And I'm sure, like, you know, if, even if I sit down all my life and read all those researchers, I'd never be done. So this is why I'm looking for research resources like your podcast and other podcasts and different websites that kind of push those insights towards me.
Yeah, there's a reason why science is a collaborative process at this point in human history. There's too much for any one person or any one team even to do.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, anything else that that you wanted to talk about?
I think something that would be interested to see, especially with the proliferation of mobile devices, is how games would become part of social media. So games are becoming more social, and we have those phones and those devices with us at all time. And it's interesting to see how that's going to evolve. I think that's something that's yet to be cracked in the market, but I'm looking forward to see who does it. Hopefully it would be us.
Yeah. So any predictions or any guess, if you want to put your futurist hat on, what would come to mind?
I'd see a hybrid of maybe a social network like Instagram or something like that, with a fantasy universe where players can be whoever they want.
So we're talking like metaverse, Snow Crash kind of thing here.
Yep, something like that.
A couple of questions to kind of close thing out. Have you been playing anything for fun, you know, outside of work or?
I'm playing our new game, the new Candy Crush, on my commute, and at home I'm playing Senua's Sacrifice on the PlayStation 4. Which
that one is still on my list. What do you think of it?
I think it's great. I think the narrative is so captivating, especially when you're playing with your headphones and you're hearing the different voices telling you what to do. It's just very different than other games I've played.
Yeah, I've heard that it has extraordinary sound design, like really effective sound design. And you're not the first person to mention or recommend wearing headphones while playing that thing, too. So, yeah, that's been on my list, especially since it touches on like the psychology and mental health theme. Yeah, as well, because the main character is suffering some sort of condition where she, like you said, she hears voices and it's an unreliable narrator kind of situation where you're not quite sure what's real and what isn't because you're seeing things from her point of view. And that sounds like it would be right up my alley. So I have a long backlog, but I keep adding things to it. I just picked up Red Dead Redemption 2, like the rest of the world, I think, and started, you know, playing through my cowboy simulator and am enjoying that. The summer or the winter release season is almost over, though. So it's almost have some relief in sight with all these new games coming out where I can go back and finish some of the ones that I started but never finished.
The problem is there's just so many games constantly coming out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's impossible to keep up. And I like to try to play different kinds of things and get exposed to different kinds of things because of the website and because of this podcast, to not get locked into a little, one little niche area like I might have in the past. But that's a tall order to try to get a representative sample of everything going on.
Yeah, I do the same. I'm trying to play games that are outside what I usually like.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm often very surprised to see that I like things that I don't think I'm going to like. But that's the fun.
How do you find out about those things? Do you just get recommendations from other people, or do you just randomly download things off the App Store or off the shelf?
Yeah, so I get recommendations from other people, and at this point, I think all of the advertisement feed on all of my devices is just games, mobile games, console games. So I've started actually clicking on advertisements, trusting that the algorithms learn what I kind of like, but also choosing as many random things as I can to not let them point me just towards
one direction. Yeah, they're not sure what to make of you. You're exactly. Keeping them on their toes. Little virtual algorithmic toes.
Yep.
Great. So where can people go on the internet to find out more about you and this type of stuff? I know that there's those two Medium articles, and I will definitely include links to those on the show notes for this episode. Is there anywhere else, any social media or anything else that King has put out, like white papers or anything like that you'd want to point people towards?
So currently there's the Medium articles, but they can follow me on Medium and they can follow linked on social media. And whenever there's cooperation between King and some studies, it always gets published.
Published there. Okay, great. Well, thanks for coming on. This was really interesting. And I'm always, speaking of trying to get a broad view of thing, I love having academics and, people who are at university and doing research on this sort of stuff, because I think they have a very core fundamental contribution. But I also like seeing people who are in some ways on the other end of the spectrum, like yourself, who are like making use of this in very practical ways and who are, working for really successful companies like King and putting this type of research to ultimate use to like figure out what people want out of games and like how does this affect what goes to market and what gets marketed to whom. So it's really fascinating, and I very much appreciate your coming on.
Thank you. And I enjoy listening to your podcast and to all the guest speakers you have, and just thought I could contribute with some of actual data about the games to back up some of the theories.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thanks.
Thank you very much. Have a great day.
Thanks once again for listening to an episode of the Psychology of Games podcast. I'm glad you did, and I hope that you enjoyed it. Remember to subscribe to the podcast and check out psychologyofgames.com. Now, on the next episode, I'm going to branch out even further in this whole psychology of games thing and talk with a fellow psychologist about the psychology of Dungeons & Dragons and similar tabletop role-playing games. Subscribe to the podcast to get that one delivered to your phone while you sleep in a non-creepy kind of way. And I'll talk to you next episode.